produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, barriers to treatment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. And today we're going to be talking about pharmacy barriers to buprenorphine treatment. On Zoom with me now is Marlena Lierup, MPH, Senior Director of Research at Work at Health, and one of the co-authors of Pharmacy Barriers to Receiving Buprenorphine Among Patients Undergoing Telemedicine Addiction Treatment, which was published online August 18, 2025, in the journal JAMA Network Open. Marlena, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Now, before we get started, tell us more about yourself. You've been involved in public health and addiction research for some time now.
Yes. So I'm a substance use researcher. I've been in the field for coming up on 15 years, and a lot of my research has been on clinical dimensions of substance use and also policy dimensions of substance use. I worked for over a decade at Boston Medical Center and joined Work at Health around 3 years ago. And Work at Health is a telemedicine treatment provider for substance use disorders, operating in multiple states and striving to provide low barrier evidenced care for addiction.
Let's get to your article. Let's start from the top. Again, the title, Pharmacy Barriers to Receiving Buprenorphine Among Patients Undergoing Telemedicine Addiction Treatment. What was the question you were looking into?
So let me set the table first. Buprenorphine is one of the two most effective medications to treat opioid use disorder, and the only medication that can be filled at pharmacies. The other medication that you've probably heard of is methadone. And methadone is highly regulated and only available in opioid treatment programs. Buprenorphine, on the other hand, can be prescribed outside of opioid treatment programs settings. So buprenorphine is really considered the gold standard treatment for opioid use disorder, and it reduces the risk of death from overdose by about 50%. So one of the silver linings of the COVID-19 pandemic was that it actually spurred the expansion of telemedicine treatment for substance use disorders. Historically, buprenorphine has really been accessible in brick and mortar treatment settings, but telemedicine allows individuals to have a Zoom call or to log into an app or to a website to meet with a provider virtually and access this evidence-based care. So people who use telemedicine are more likely to receive medications for opioid use disorder, and telemedicine treatment has been associated with a reduced risk of overdose mortality. But in order for telemedicine treatment or even brick and mortar treatment for opioid use disorder to be effective, individuals need to be able to fill their prescriptions for buprenorphine. They need to be able to pick them up from pharmacies. So the whole idea behind this study was to tackle and describe a real problem that is experienced within our telemedicine treatment practice. As I mentioned, Work at Health is a multi-state telemedicine treatment provider for substance use disorders. And we really took off during the pandemic and after, although we were actually founded beforehand in 2015 by people, two women who are in recovery themselves, really with the ethos that our patients are our designers. So we had been noticing that over the last several years, our patients, our members, were experiencing challenges at pharmacies when they would go to pick up their prescriptions. And again, these are prescriptions that are legitimately being prescribed for opioid use disorder in order to prevent overdose, to stabilize people, to give them a chance at recovery. And so we wanted to understand really the scope of this problem and try to describe it in order to shed a light on this. Because even though we're operating within a telemedicine practice, this is actually a problem that is going on nationwide among patients receiving treatment in brick and mortar settings, in telemedicine settings, really everywhere. just because we were operating, across multiple states with a pretty large patient size and patient sample, we were able to kind of do a pretty large survey to understand what was actually going on. And so that's what we did. We did a cross-sectional survey. So we invited a bunch of our patients who were in our care to participate. And we asked them about a lot of dimensions of their care, and pharmacy barriers was just one component of the questionnaire. We enrolled 600 patients, actually 601, and we tried to evenly split it across people living in rural areas and people living in urban areas. And we were able to figure that out through zip codes. And what we found was that nearly one third of the respondents reported having to go without buprenorphine in the last year because of a pharmacy barrier. This is a really, really big problem. When people can't get their buprenorphine, they start to experience physical withdrawal, which is extremely uncomfortable, and it puts them at risk of returning to use of illicit substances. And it also puts them at increased risk of overdose and death, not to mention hospitalizations, infections, and all sorts of other issues that can come through that as well.
So what did you find?
Nearly one third of folks said that they had to go without buprenorphine in the last year because of a pharmacy barrier. And of the ones who reported this, 25% said that they actually had to go 7 or more days without medication. And interestingly, the most common problem that was reported was that the pharmacy was out of stock of buprenorphine and needed to basically order it to get it back in stock. Most folks ultimately did have a resolution to the problem, about 86%. And strangely enough, most actually reported being satisfied with pharmacy experiences. But I think this also goes to show just how much stigma patients with opioid use disorder are living with, and that even, in this type of situation, they may still consider themselves satisfied, even though they're really at risk of harm and poor health outcomes because of these challenges.
I saw in the study you referred to the possibility of recall bias that I suppose at a certain point you sort of get used to people to the you sort of get used to being ill-treated or being blown off or just or ignored. And so if someone finally comes through, then hey, no complaints.
But I think that's spot on, and that speaks to just how much externalized stigma individuals with substance use orders experience in society. And even though there is a chance of, say, recall bias, there have been a number of studies that have started to shine a light on this issue. And our findings were followed up by a study actually just last week in Health Affairs, and it was from another group of researchers. So I was not involved in the study. It was out of the University of Southern California, but they basically looked at pharmacy data nationwide and found that in 2023, only 39% of retail pharmacies regularly dispensed buprenorphine. And there was a lot of variation across states. So some states, like Oregon, actually had around 80% of pharmacies regularly dispensing buprenorphine. But on the other hand, like Washington, D.C., Virginia, North Dakota, around 20% or less. And some areas, some rural states are very spread out. People already have to drive very, very long distances. And for there not to be pharmacies in a county or a certain area that's stocking buprenorphine makes it even harder for individuals to access what's really the gold standard FDA-approved evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder.
You know, a major barrier that people who use drugs face when it comes to accessing health care and hospital services in general is stigma. Not to put too fine a point on it, but when trying to access health care, people who use drugs are discriminated against, stigmatized, even dehumanized. And in the current climate with this administration, it's only going to get worse. telehealth could, you know, help to mitigate these problems, you'd think, by letting people access services directly without having to interact physically with the gatekeepers like the receptionists and the security guards and the people in the waiting room who don't like your shirt, your hair, your shoes, giving you a stink eye for just being in their presence. But people still have to deal with the physical world when it comes to accessing this medication. The X waiver was repealed a few years ago to make it easier for people to prescribe buprenorphine. But it's the question of how to get it. I mean, one of the reasons that Addiction Consult, I was just talking to Sean Cohen, a professor at Yale, doctor, an MD and a professor over at Yale, who'd done some research also in JAMA about Addiction Consult services and finding that they're adapting, how they're adapting in terms of method opioid use disorder in people presenting in the finding that buprenorphine, one of the reasons for recommending buprenorphine is just that methadone is so heavily regulated and so difficult to get into a methadone program. In the hospital, they have more leeway to prescribe methadone as a treatment, but once they're out of the hospital, they're in the regular system, and that's a pain. And so buprenorphine with the X waiver. But the notion of what they do then, how do they, I mean, oh, great, you're in the program, you got the script. Now, good luck getting your drugs. It wasn't a question in there. That, again, was just sort of me griping. But can you talk a bit more about stigma, some of the stumbling blocks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're spot on. People experience stigma in multiple aspects of the healthcare system. It can be from healthcare providers themselves who may not have received training that's up to date and reflects best practices with regard to substance use disorders. But it can also come through security guards, and it can show its face in logistical challenges like needing to request time off from work, which may or may not be granted for that medical appointment. But in addition, individuals with substance use disorders have all sorts of other very normal real life challenges like childcare, right? Or transportation barriers. And telemedicine cuts through a lot of those issues. Individuals can log on through the comfort of their home. They don't need to worry about childcare. They really just need an internet connection. There are different types of telemedicine services available, but what Work at Health does that I think is so spectacular is that we ensure that our app continues to work with older models of phones. We also have a website, things to try to really think, we were founded by people in recovery. And as a result, we really try to put the patient experience first. And that even, impacts our Zoom backgrounds, for example. We just did a study about Zoom backgrounds and preferences of our patients. It turns out that people who are engaging in telemedicine treatment for opioid use disorder don't really like the virtual backgrounds and prefer, real Zoom backgrounds where they can see what's actually going on. And that could very well be because of things like stigma and fear of concern of lack of privacy, and all of the things that you just mentioned. So telemedicine really has been, I think, a turning point for opioid use disorder, and it's enabling more and more people to get access to really good care in a totally different way.
This is my conversation with Marlena Lira, MPH, Senior Director of Research at Work at Health, and one of the co-authors of Pharmacy Barriers to Receiving Buprenorphine Among Patients Undergoing Telemedicine Addiction Treatment, published online August 18, 2025, in the journal JAMA Network Open. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Welcome back. Now let's hear the rest of my conversation with Marlena Lira, MPH, Senior Director of Research at Work at Health, and one of the co-authors of Pharmacy Barriers to Receiving Buprenorphine Among Patients Undergoing Telemedicine Addiction Treatment, which was published online August 18, 2025, in the journal JAMA Network Open. Let's get back to your article, which again, folks, is entitled Pharmacy Barriers to Receiving Buprenorphine Among Patients Undergoing Telemedicine Addiction Treatment, the journal JAMA Network Open, August 18th. So now, what are the policy implications of your findings?
There's a lot of work that needs to be done here in order to improve access. And some of it can be done on a practice level, but other components really need to be done at a policy level. So from a practice level, there are various solutions that we're working on at Work It Health. We are creating a pharmacy finder so that our patients can locate a pharmacy that we've had success with recently. And that way, if they hit a snag, they have a very easy way of finding another pharmacy that will fill their prescription. For example, we've also worked on developing partnerships with some amazing pharmacies that really understand substance use disorders and opioid use disorders and the importance of getting medications to patients in a timely fashion. And these pharmacy partners are actually doing home delivery of buprenorphine. So in some of our states, we have home delivery available to our members so they can just get it through UPS or FedEx or USPS and bypass the local pharmacy experience. So those are some of the things that we're doing to try to problem solve this. But that's not really, you know, going to go beyond the patients that we serve. On a policy level, there are local policies that could make a dent, and then there are also federal policies that could make a dent in the issue. In terms of local policies, the city, county, San Francisco, the jurisdiction of San Francisco, created an ordinance in 2024 that actually required pharmacies to maintain stocks of buprenorphine. It's the first of its kind, and it was kind of modeled on similar legislation in Philadelphia, I believe, around naloxone. And there have been other jurisdictions that have required the stocking of naloxone and also emergency contraception. So using some of those rules that have been put into place to say pharmacies need to have, you know, say two extra prescriptions of buprenorphine at any time, or, you know, a stock, take your daily average and add one to two more prescriptions on top of that so that new patients can start medications. There are things like that being considered in multiple states. I'm involved in some work in New Mexico along those lines where I live, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But it's very tricky because it's not as simple as the pharmacies just not wanting to stock buprenorphine. Pharmacies themselves are experiencing barriers when they request more buprenorphine. And some of this ironically comes from the opioid settlement agreements. So when the opioid settlement agreements were agreed upon, they created these thresholds that distributors needed to follow in filling requests and stocks for controlled substances. So opioid settlement agreements were very well intended. They were trying to undo the proliferation of opioids, which led to the opioid epidemic in the first place. But they've had this unintended side effect, which is that because buprenorphine is a controlled substance, it's also subject to these stocking limits. So pharmacies may try requesting more buprenorphine only to be told by a distributor, you know, you've reached your cap, we can't increase, you know, you have to wait until the next calendar month. So there's this very complicated web of players of the patients, the providers, the pharmacies, the distributors, and then there's also the DEA. The DEA has come out and said, we actually think, you know, everybody who has opioid use disorder should have free access to buprenorphine. We're not interested in auditing pharmacies for high quantities of buprenorphine, but it's very complicated from a policy perspective. So Ideally, what would happen is that buprenorphine would be taken out of a system called the Suspicious Orders Reporting System, Suspicious Orders Report System, which is intended to flag suspicious orders for controlled substances. And actually, a year ago, there was a bill that was introduced by Senators Heinrich and Tonko to actually remove buprenorphine from this, to give it more leeway in how it's requested and fulfilled, to reduce suspicious reporting of buprenorphine. But another thing that could be done is that the state attorneys general could go back to the opioid settlement agreements and remove buprenorphine from these strict restrictions. That's also very complicated. And the bill that I just mentioned, because it was introduced in the last Congress, it would need to be reintroduced again in order for it to continue moving forward. So I think there are multiple things that could move the needle, but it's really going to come down to, on a local level, things like relationships. Do the pharmacies know who the providers are, vice versa? Do they trust one another? What are the relationships between the pharmacies and the distributors? What are the state departments of health doing? And then larger macro policy issues that can hopefully kind of change the landscape and make buprenorphine more accessible.
What have I not yet asked that I should have?
One question that I think is interesting is, how does this differ by state? And in our study, we found pretty significant variation across state. Now, I mention that because I think it shows how some of these local factors can play into larger issues. So when we asked the question, in the past 12 months, have you had any problems filling your buprenorphine prescription? Across our 5-state sample, Ohio was the lowest with 22%. And then Florida was the highest at 45.5%. And so we've experienced within our practice that there's something interesting going on in Florida. And when I've talked to pharmacists in Florida and who operate in Florida, I've been really surprised at their response, which is to say, well, of course Florida is going to have bigger problems when it comes to buprenorphine. Florida was hit so hard with pill mills and OxyContin. The pendulum has really swung the other way. And so I say that to remind us that the local context really makes a difference, and things like trust and relationships might need to be worked on in certain contexts more than others. There are also obviously political things going on that vary by state, and state governments look very, very different as well. But there are some states that are really trying hard to increase access to evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder. And I think that variation across states is seen both in the paper that we published and also in the health affairs paper that I mentioned a few minutes ago, that literally looks at every state and the availability of buprenorphine in pharmacies.
A quick side note, our personal Neville, 3 years, 11 months, and 14 days. As we are recording this, on the day that we're recording this, I am 3 years, 11 months, and 14 days into recovery. I stopped using alcohol entirely almost 4 years ago. And I mentioned that because when I was preparing for our interview, I saw that you recently joined the board of the U.S. Alcohol Policy Alliance. Please, tell me about them. They look interesting.
Well, first of all, Doug, congratulations. What an amazing celebration that will be, and all my best to you. Congratulations. Thank you for bringing up the U.S. Alcohol Policy Alliance. I'm thrilled to have joined it last month. The U.S. Alcohol Policy Alliance is a national nonprofit that seeks to do research, education, and support policy initiatives, all related to reducing the burden of harms from alcohol in the United States. And even though alcohol isn't in the news as much as opioid use disorder, and of course, yes, we are still in the throes of an opioid overdose epidemic, alcohol actually causes more than twice as many deaths each year than overdose. More than 175,000 deaths in the United States. That's a lot of people. And alcohol is also associated with at least 7 types of cancer and a whole host of chronic health conditions. Alcohol really contributes to early death in the United States. And what's particularly sad about deaths from alcohol is that when they occur, they're typically very young, and people have entire lives ahead of them often. So just the public health toll from excessive alcohol use is quite large in the United States. And the United States Alcohol Policy Alliance is working to create a national strategy around alcohol policy and also supporting states with various policy initiatives, from things like increasing alcohol excise taxes to lowering the legal blood alcohol content limit for driving, even to cancer warning labels on alcohol purchases as well. So there are a lot of effective policy interventions that can really reduce harms from alcohol. And the US Alcohol Policy Alliance is working to really move the field forward and be a national voice for a long-term strategy to improve the health of Americans.
That was my conversation with Marlena Lira, MPH, Senior Director of Research at Work at Health, and one of the co-authors of Pharmacy Barriers to Receiving Buprenorphine Among Patients Undergoing Telemedicine Addiction Treatment, an article which was published online August 18, 2025, in the journal JAMA Network Open. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture, along with an archive of past shows. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare and is used with permission of the artist. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!